Welcome back to the Sideshow Theme Show. This is our newest show where we discuss a single theme, leitmotif, song, track, or cue we love, and of course, why we love it. I am once again your host, Will, and once again, I am joined by none other than the Wizard of Wit himself. Hailing from the mystical lands of Germany, it's only my esteemed co-host and resident spellcaster, Lasse Fort.
Hello, how's it going, dear listeners? Lasse Vogt is here to grace your ears with magical podcasting. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you doing, sir?
Yeah, pretty nice. I am very excited to continue with this wonderful show. And I'm very happy that we landed on a theme this time, which has a very special place in my heart. I mean, all of these have. This one is, is especially special to me.
Well, since you alluded to it, what is the theme we will be talking about today, my good friend?
The theme is going to be basically the main theme of the TV two-parter from 1998, Merlin, composed by Trevor Jones.
Composed by renowned South African composer Trevor Jones, Merlin's main theme, introduced as the Age of Magic on album, serves as the anchor point for a musical tapestry that seamlessly blends elements of fantasy writing, medieval instrumentation, royal bombast, and darkly magical underpinnings. It's a composition that stands out as something wholly unique and wonderfully memorable. Notably, this wasn't Trevor Jones' first foray into the realm of fantastical storytelling. In fact, Merlin marked his fourth collaboration with the Jim Henson Company, following his work on The Dark Crystal, The Labyrinth, and Loch Ness. Moreover, Jones wasn't a stranger to Arthurian legend either, having previously scored the considerably less magical Excalibur in 1981, a pivotal moment that propelled him into the industry spotlight. Released by Verez Saraband as a 10-track CD in 1998, Merlin Brackett's original soundtrack is a release you either love or hate, depending on whether or not you like tracks that approach 15 minutes in length, but no matter which way your wand waves, there's no denying the crispness of Simon Rhodes' assured recording, the magic of the London Symphony Orchestra's performance, nor the grandeur of Abbey Road Studios, where this epic score was recorded. Lasse, you sort of mentioned it in the intro, but what are your thoughts on the Age of Magic / Merlin main theme, my friend?
Well, I remember watching Merlin as a kid on TV several times, though I don't think we watched it when it first aired over here in Germany, but it was immediately captivating. I think it's a great version of a famous tale, which uses its cast well, and the sometimes cheap-looking effects I don't mind at all. They add to the charm, although it is interesting to see how far we've come since then, especially in terms of effects work in TV shows. I mean, there's even a young Lena Headey in this, playing Guinevere. So it's a precursor of Game of Thrones in a way. Again, showing her as royalty. And this two-parter was directed by Steve Barron, a true journeyman when it comes to TV and film. And his probably most well-known project is the original live-action Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles film. He very often got hired for projects which involved a certain amount of effects. I also recall the music really leaving an impression on me back then. And I didn't know it was Trevor Jones, whose work I had already encountered thanks to Labyrinth. But they absolutely did not cheap out when it comes to this score, conducted by Jeff Alexander and orchestrated by Trevor Jones, Jeff Alexander, Julian Kershaw, Edmund Butt, and John Bell. And this main theme, sorry to be so grand and extensive again, but this might be one of my favorite fantasy themes ever.
Oh, there's nothing wrong with saying that. It's truly amazing.
Yeah, high praise once again. it just sounds all around so magical, and the orchestrations are so lush and rich, which with so much depth, like, there's a sense of longing to the theme, and it sounds both heroic but also very emotional. It's a perfect introduction to this world, the characters, and the score, and we get to hear many variations of it.
Yeah, my introduction to this actually came when I was living at home with my parents back when my father was still alive, and he actually watched this, and he kept telling me, he's like, this is amazing, you have to see this, you have to see this, and for some reason, I never did until you actually suggested we talk about this main theme. Now, the main theme I've been familiar with for years because I am a fan of Trevor Jones. His Last of the Mohicans theme, I think, is one of the most memorable themes I've heard in soundtracks that aren't necessarily fantasy-based or you know, actually action-adventure-based or superhero-based. It's a very, very solid main theme that I think we'll probably end up talking about at some point on the show. The only thing that I remember thinking when I would kind of go past the TV and my father was watching this was Miranda Richardson, and thinking, I think a year later when I saw Sleepy Hollow, that it was essentially the same character as what she was playing in this. It's not meant to be a slight against Miranda Richardson. I love Miranda Richardson, most notably and most recently in the Good Omens series. I love her in everything I've ever seen her in, the Harry Potter series. She's awesome. But she's, you know, she chews up every scene she's in this miniseries, and I think was perfectly cast, as was everyone. Sam Neill's great. Helena Bonham Carter is in this. Isabella Rossellini is in this. Martin Short. I mean, there's just so much really, really good acting talent in this miniseries.
Oh, yeah. And don't forget the late Rutger Hauer, who left our world a few years ago, because he plays such a bastard in this.
His character actually reminds me of the same character he played in Batman Begins. Yeah, this theme, because I know that's what we're here to talk about. This theme is, and of course, the track, The Age of Magic, excuse me, has been playing in the background this whole time. It's an incredibly long track on album. It's almost 15 minutes long. So it serves as kind of the perfect music to just play while we talk about the miniseries. But the theme itself, which you hear in the first 30 seconds or so, it's beautifully majestic. It's surprisingly actually majestic to my ears. It sounds to me, and it always has, to be incredibly royal sounding. And incredibly magical at the same time. It weaves them together perfectly. It's interesting because it only takes 30 seconds to state this thing fully. And after that, it's completely ingrained in your brain. It's there. It doesn't go anywhere after that. It's so well written. It's also, to me, and you may correct me on this, if you feel differently, of course, but it's the kind of fantasy theme that we don't really get a lot of these days because it's very earnest. It's a very earnest theme. It's almost, I would say, too earnest for modern directors. And, of course, we'll get to this in a bit. It's incredibly malleable.
Yes.
This 10-track soundtrack, which some love, some hate. I love it personally. I mean, I do think some of these 15-minute tracks could have been broken up into individual cues, of course. But taking it as it is, it's a really well-constructed journey through the miniseries, musically, in my opinion. I think it's a great listening experience. And there are so many interesting ways that Trevor Jones brings the theme back. And a lot of them are represented on album. So it's a theme I love. It's a miniseries I now love. You mentioned the special effects. I don't mind them at all. They don't take me out of it. I think it's great. And I'm ashamed that it's taken me this long to actually sit down and watch this. But I certainly am glad I have. Thanks to you.
There are a lot of memorable visuals in this, and I think they use the budget also well to make it appropriately epic in a way. I think, like, especially like in the finale of part two, where it's basically like the big the battle, Arthur versus Mordred and their two armies, and I really like how how the battle takes place in just this foggy forest, and you just see snippets of a battle. You have to just like always just like a few people in the background fighting, but you can imagine this greater thing going on beyond that.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because I probably would have forgotten to it, because this is something I actually made a mental note to say. It reminds me, and I promise you this is going somewhere, it reminds me of how the shark was utilized in Jaws, where it's what you don't see in Jaws, which of course was a limitation to the filmmakers, to Steven Spielberg, when they filmed Jaws. It was like, obviously, the shark wasn't working, they had to hide it. And what you ended up with was this beautifully Hitchcockian approach where It's what you don't see. It's what your imagination fills in. Of course, we're talking about something completely different with this battle scene, but it's the same. To me, it's the same thing. They didn't have the budget to give us the battle they probably wanted to give us. The theater of the mind sort of fills that in.
Yeah, yeah. And the battle scene in the first part, I think it's really well handled too, where you have some establishing shots where you have like a big crowd of people and some of it digitally enhanced. And for the most part, you stay, you know, within the reins, and it's taking place on a frozen river, which you don't see very often, which we always found incredibly cool as kids. And then at the very end, when the battle is over, you have like this big establishing shot of the battlefield, and it tells you the story. Oh yeah, this was a really big thing, and we just basically saw kind of like snippets of it, but it still feels epic. It still feels very forceful, and that's something I really enjoy. Like, they really did this stuff well, especially because the principal photography, like, production began only like 6 months before the intended release date, which was pretty insane.
It deserves more love than it probably gets. I don't know. I've never met anyone that dislikes this, but I don't hear a lot of people talking about it. And of course, there's the newer Merlin series that came out that I think overshadows this one.
Yeah, in a way, because it's, you know, so popular, especially with the younger crowd. And this one, and that has nothing to do with this two-parter. And there was a sequel two-parter to this in 2006, which isn't as well known, where Sam Neill and Miranda Richardson both came back, but it has a different tone. It has kind of like a confusing story. It's not that great, but you know, the acting is still fine, and it's basically a sequel which disregards the ending of this first one. And you mentioned something about the kind of like the earnestness of the music, because this is something I heard on a podcast said by the great Tom Crowley, who I also had on my own podcast, and he said it on the Smirchpod in regards to The Last Jedi, where he said that nowadays filmmakers have a problem with archness, because everything kind of like needs to have like the safety net of humor in a way.
Yeah.
And you know, not everything, but you could certainly tell. And even like in terms of music, where even like the most heroic of like, you know, MCU superhero themes or whatever, you have this kind of like, they are almost like so grand in a way, it's kind of like overdoing it a little bit. But also, you know, it's appropriate for the characters, but it's still, there's still at other points in the music, there's this kind of like safety net. And that is something I enjoyed so immensely about Rings of Power, because there they allowed the material to be earnest. And it seems like they didn't care what people would like think or make fun of, because there's this sequence in the first episode of Rings of Power where the elves are on the boat and they just start singing, because that's something they explain before that stuff. And you would never see this in a, you know, in a modern thing. But here they just present it as that, and they don't make any jokes. It's just here, this is something they do. And I thought that fits so well, how they just take everything very, very seriously without, you know, being extremely dour or boring or dark or whatever, but still presenting it in a way we're taking this seriously, no prisoners.
It's interesting you say that. Yeah, it seems like we've entered, and this is probably a topic for another podcast, but it seems like we've entered an age where Hollywood is, you know, kind of painfully self-aware of itself and probably too insecure to let the earnestness be what it is. And I think that's missing in modern filmmaking. But again, that's probably a topic for another day. But I do agree. Yeah, that's an interesting insight for sure. Let's move into variations. I think both of us have a lot of favorite variations of this Age of Magic theme, or Merlin main theme, if you like to call it either of those things. I think both are appropriate, but what is your favorite, or what are your favorite variations of the Merlin main theme?
Well, I mean, my absolute favorite is basically the, you know, the first like main theme statement at the beginning of Age of Magic. But if I would pick another one, and I just have this one, even though, you know, there are tons of wonderful variations, but my special pick for this one, it's a variation we also hear in the first track of the album, Age of Magic, and it starts at 3 minutes and 12 seconds and accompanies the scene where a young Merlin first meets the love of his life, Nimue, in the woods. And it's a cute scene, and the version of a theme is very special, starting with soft strings, harp, and maybe also a piano? I'm not quite sure, actually. But right afterwards, elements of the theme continue on violins and cellos, and that is the part I absolutely adore. This really shows how genius of a composer Trevor Jones is, and it was around this point in time he just didn't miss once with his scores. And this variation of a main theme, it has such a gentleness to it, and it sounds so unbelievably beautiful. I can feel myself being swept away every time.
It's always great to get such a beautifully orchestrated theme reduced down to like lovely harp plucks. It shows the inner workings of the theme and the harmony in a way that the big orchestration often doesn't. And so I do really appreciate that you chose that part of it. But then again, you mentioned that lush but very light string arrangement at the end. It's so perfect. It's so perfect. And of course, we've mentioned this already. This opening track is the better part of 15 minutes long. So you get a lot of variation just in this one track. And since we are kind of talking about this track, I love the end of this track and the statement we get there. I think we should at least mention that. There's a nice little statement. Not little at all. It's actually quite a big statement of the Merlin theme that ends the Age of Magic. Yeah, in a way, it's almost like this track is prepping you for all the statements that we're going to hear throughout the score.
Yeah, I like how, you know, many, even like modern soundtrack albums are structured in a way where you have basically kind of like a big main theme statement, so you know what to look out for the rest of the album. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I think actually, because that version also basically is like the main end credit, sometimes I think that could be just reserved for the end of the album, but of course, if you listen to it in your own library, you could rearrange it. That's fine. But yeah, I really like it when you immediately know, okay, this is something I have to pay attention to because this is clearly the main theme. And sometimes that's problematic with albums which don't do that.
Yeah. Especially for soundtrack fans who love to look for thematic variations or little Easter eggs that pop up and stuff. Yeah, a soundtrack like this and an introduction like this is actually really great. You know, we've spent most of the time so far just talking about the first track, and I think there's a lot of good reasons for that. There are a few variations that I'd like to point out that go beyond this one. The very next track, The Dragon's Lair, at 2 minutes and 38 seconds, it really highlights kind of what a shapeshifter this theme is. You get... I love this variation. You get these disconcerting descending plucks and mallet hits and harp and what sounds to me like vibraphone and celeste, although it could be, you know, glockenspiel. I mean, there's a lot of things that could be. Thank you. those descending notes against what is essentially almost a straight quotation of the main line in violins is very cool. It's a very cool juxtaposition and such an interesting arrangement.
Yeah, I found it neat that you picked some statements which aren't quite as obvious and also quite sinister.
Yeah. Well, that's the genius of the score. I mean, this one stood out to me almost immediately because it was so different, I have another one in here that's really, really interesting, in my opinion. But we'll get to that. The next one that I sort of highlighted are "The Walls Are Whispering," which is another super long track, but another really cool variation of the main theme. Around the 4 minute and 40 second mark, there's what sounds like a bass or alto flute, though honestly, could just as easily be a more exotic woodwind as well. It's really hard to tell because it's kind of buried in the mix. It's one of those statements you love to listen out for as a soundtrack fan because, you know, you can almost miss this moment if you're not paying attention.
Yeah, I never noticed this before, and it's so well done. Thank you for pointing it out.
My pleasure. Yeah, it's an interesting statement. And again, this soundtrack is loaded with little moments like this. I think my favorite statement of the main theme, my favorite variation of it, and this really is a proper statement, it comes at the 2 minute mark of Reunited. This is the kind of variation you kind of live for as a composer because your theme really gets the chance to pull at the heartstrings in a way that you simply can't without, you know, context like this.
Yeah. I mean, it's we shouldn't spoil it. It's the very end of a two-parter. But I remember all of us, like my family and I, watching it. And we were absolutely enchanted and moved to tears by that scene.
Me too. I think it's the most heart-wrenching moment this theme gets to live in the whole thing. The last one that I kind of wanted to mention, this to me was the most interesting, Game of Intrigue. A Game of Intrigue has a couple of really nice statements and variations, starting at the 3 minute mark. Now, this is really interesting because it starts with like just balls out romanticism. But then did you catch the really cool brass sort of fractal of the theme? Check this out.
Yeah, I think I kind of noticed that.
Yeah, it's a really clever little sneaky statement of just a little fragment of the theme that's really cool. One other thing that I wanted to say, I'm sure you caught this, but his action writing is very similar to Michael Giacchino's action writing.
Yes.
I've never heard another composer who sounds like Michael Giacchino. And again, you could probably say, well, that means Michael Giacchino sounds a lot like Trevor Jones. Of course, you know, no one's like stylistically ripping anyone off. It's just that they've obviously got very similar reference points when it comes to action writing, and especially in the mallets. It's more in the mallets and that sort of stuff. That's the thing that Giacchino likes to do, especially. But I thought that was cool because, you know, it just makes me want to check out even more of Trevor Jones' stuff. I just want to end what I've said about all these different statements. The main theme is so well implemented in this score that it literally sounds like the soundtrack could break into a statement of it at any time.
Mm-hmm.
That's really, really, really great if you can do that.
Oh yeah, it's the whole core. And this core isn't just this main theme alone. There are countless other brilliant moments just waiting for you, dear listeners, to discover on your own in case you aren't already familiar with the music. It's very much worthy of your time. But it's the theme, how it gets rearranged, how it just pops up here and there, and just always just fragments. Like I said, one of my favorite statements is just it kind of like being fragmented and not really fully stated until a little later. And that's the power of it. That's something, you know, when a composer gets the time to develop that sort of stuff, it's really rewarding and for the ages.
Yeah, well said. Well said. It's such an enchanting score. It's such a beautifully represented score on album. I think the album presentation is just gorgeous. Of course, you've got the London Symphony Orchestra, you've got Simon Rhodes, you've got Abbey Road, you've got Trevor Jones. I mean, you really can't go wrong with the ingredients here. And as we mentioned, the miniseries itself is well worth a look if you haven't seen it, like I hadn't, or a revisit if you haven't watched it in, oh my God, what would that be, 16 years? Longer than that. No, 24 years. What am I saying? It's been quite a long time. So yeah, go back and give it a chance. And by the way, Wendell Jones has a lot of fondness for this one also. So it's definitely, I think, a prime candidate for a future score guide if you want us to do one. So any closing thoughts on Merlin, my friend, and this incredible, extraordinary Trevor Jones theme?
Well, I think, you know, the album presentation is a little bit problematic when you're looking for your, you know, favorite moments. And I wished they would someday give us like a complete release and scene order with a more convenient track arrangement. But that's really, you know, that's nitpicking on a very high level. And that small issue aside, as I already said, this is a tremendous score, full of heart, power, and yes, magic. And it is a true shame that Hollywood in particular seems to have forgotten about Trevor Jones, because I would give anything to hear him compose for a superhero or big budget fantasy film of today once again.
Oh yeah. You know, he's one of those guys that brings a really interesting angle to his work that, you know, it's informed by growing up in South Africa, certainly, and the things that he experienced. I mean, he's got an interesting backstory when you go back and kind of look at where he came from and mm-hmm. what he dealt with growing up. And, you know, the stuff that he's worked on is also an interesting combination of things. I mean, he's done a couple Daniel Day-Lewis films, for example, which, you know, not that that is a genre unto itself, but certainly, you know, films of a more serious note than something like this, or, you know, certainly, you know, an MCU film or something like that. But then again, he has done Henson Productions, and he's just got an interesting back catalog that's well worthy of examination. And, you know, I, for one, after doing this episode, certainly want to go back and revisit some of the stuff I haven't either listened to in a while or haven't listen to it all. So.
Oh yeah, I can absolutely recommend his score for League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, which features the same type of like action writing he does here. It's kind of like his patented sound in a way, and it's very similar in terms of that. Also co-orchestrated by him and Jeff Alexander once again conducting, and it's also really worth checking out. And the film itself, you know, it's not very good, but it kind of has, you know, some fun moments. And the music is a big part of that.
Well, Lasse, if people wanted to find you online, sir, how would they do so?
I am all over the place. I am part of course, this very one, SideshowSoundTheater.com, where you can also find TrackSwap, my very own show, with new episodes coming soon. My own podcast is called Fans About Films. You can find it pretty much anywhere good or better podcasts can be found. I write score reviews for scoregeek.wordpress.com. I'm on YouTube, The Deppard, and if you want to be a guest on one of my shows, you could find me on Facebook or Twitter at Lasse Vogt.
Yeah, you're very quickly becoming a renaissance man. There's a lot of stuff that you're involved in, and it's all awesome. So you should absolutely follow those links and check his stuff out. And I'm not just saying that again, because we're on a show together, bro. I really mean it.
Thank you very much. Thank you. I'm humbled.
I mean every word, sir. And if you, for some reason, want to find me on X, or as we like to call it around here, Twitter, my handle is @will_Dodson1. To find everything we at Sideshow have done, are doing, or will do in the future, please make your way over to SideshowSoundTheater.com, spelled the British way. And there you can find all of our previous shows, including Lasse's show, Track Swap. as well as every single album Wendell Jones and myself have released under our writing pseudonym Sideshow Sound Theater. You can also find us online on X, at Sideshow Sound, as well as Facebook, Sideshow Sound Theater, spelled the British way, R-E at the end. And yeah, we've got lots of stuff coming up. And as mentioned in the last couple of episodes, we are also working diligently to get our entire back catalog up online and available for you, the listener. So yeah, in the meantime, we'll see you next time. I've been Will.
And I've been Lasse.
And we've been the Sideshow Theme Show. You have a great week. We'll see you right back here for episode 4.
Have a great and magical week.
Enjoyed this Sideshow Sound Radio podcast? Why not share it with your friends? Share and enjoy.
I'm amazing.